alternative to this view that I think is sort of gaining in popularity because it's subtle and it promises to deliver a lot of things that we would hope to get from a normative theory. But I also think as philosophers we know that with subtlety comes a whole new suite of problems that suggest that sometimes the old ham-handed approaches are better. So let me just discuss a position I like in epistemology with, but I'm going to start as we're outside of the epistemic domain, because I think to see the virtues of this epistemological view, it's helpful to think about sort of some broader issues having to do with normativity, both epistemic and practical, and then think about the relationship between those spheres, sort of practical and theoretical reason. So H.A. Pritchard raises this question. If a person has an obligation, does the obligation depend upon characteristics of the situation that they're in, or characteristics of their thought about the situation? And if you are what I'll call an externalist in the practical domain, then you think that an agent's obligation, at least sometimes, can depend upon objective features of the situation. And these, I think, are the things that we normally have in mind when we're trying to decide what to do. So, you know, when we're trying to decide what to do, Sartre, you know, is focused on things like the health of his mother and the needs of his country, and it's all outward looking. If you're, you know, going to meet a friend for lunch who needs help, but you see a child has fallen in the pond, again, your attention seems to be focused on your friend and the child. It seems like all of our attention is outward looking, and the things that we naturally think of as the pros and cons that we list in trying to decide what to do, they tend to be considerations about the situations we face, not considerations about us. And so you have writers like Jonathan Dancy, who'll say things like, the situations we face have a kind of practical shape, and the task of practical judgment is to take account of that shape, a shape that's constituted by features of the situation, and then guide us in making a decision. Then you have people like G.E. Moore, who had a really radical version of this view, and he would say things like, the only possible reason that could ever justify any action is that by action the greatest amount of what is good would be produced. And then you have less radical versions of this. But this idea that somehow the objective nature of the situation, at least in part, helps determine what you ought to do, that's a kind of externalist view. And you can contrast that with a kind of internalism in the practical domain. People who think that, no, only characteristics or facts about the agent's mental life will determine what the agent ought to do. And you can find a version of this, for example, in Kant, because many Kantians still believe that when it comes to moral assessment, the moral assessment that determines the permissibility or the justification or the legality of the agent's action, it has all to do with the quality of the agent's will. You know, so could an agent consistently will that this is done? If the answer is yes, then that thing becomes permitted no matter how bad things turn out. Right, so that's a kind of Kantian thought that, as it were, the permissibility will determine upon these characteristics of thought, although we can all agree that it's unfortunate that people sometimes do the right thing because of catastrophe. All right, so that's a practical question, but of course similar debates play out in epistemology. So if you think about someone like John McDowell has this slogan he likes to toss around where he says knowledge is a standing in the space of reasons, and he seems to mean two different things by that. One thing he seems to mean is that when you know something that's based upon the reasons that are available to you, or those reasons seem to be understood as, you know, facts made manifest to you in various ways, through perception, through testimony, through introspection, etc. But he also seems to think that knowledge is a standing in the space of reasons. The idea being here that beliefs aspire to be something, and they have positive standing or status, that of being justified, appropriate, or as it were, something you have the right to believe, only if they, as it were, meet the knowledge standard, that those beliefs constitute knowledge. So if the facts aren't made manifest to you, you, not only do you fail to know, you fail to believe what you ought to believe. But if the facts are made manifest to you and your belief constitutes knowledge, then you do believe what you ought to believe. That idea that, as it were, you believe the right thing about the weather only if the weather is as you take it to be is one that very few epistemologists like. It's one that I find attractive. I find wheeling McDowell out is quite helpful in these contexts, because if I say it's my view, everyone will laugh, but if I say it's McDowell's view, it gets a difference. But I like this idea that both in the practical domain and the epistemic domain, that there's this kind of liability where we're always going to be answerable to objective features of the circumstance, and that's something that we can't shake. Okay. So part of what motivates the externalism that I'm going to discuss here is this answer to Pritchard's question that features of the circumstance are part of what determines what an agent's obligation is. If we want to link these two things together, I think it's good to think about a different British moralist. This is Alfred's Cyril Ewing. So A.C. Ewing had this book, Ethics, and in this book he said something like, "It is a recognized principle of ethics that it is always our duty to do roughly what we think we ought to do." And sometimes when people read that principle, they think of it as a kind of self-reliance principle. So you should sort of trust in your own judgment, and once you've judged that something ought to be done, as it were, that should, you know, that should resonate through your body. Those kinds of thoughts aren't things you should just keep to yourself. They should sort of wiggle your pineal gland, move the body into action, and lead you to places. But if you really think about that kind of self-reliance thing, it does seem like it's potentially disastrous. And so if you flip the page, you see on the next page, Ewing says, well, actually, you can see this is a bit problematic, and you can think about the various ways in which it is. Because, of course, his example is, I might judge that I ought to fight for my country, and Benoit judges that he ought to fight for his country, but if we're fighting for two different countries, now it looks like morality is sort of pitting Benoit and I against each other in a terrible way, and Ewing thinks that there's some kind of contradiction contained in that. I'm not entirely sure that there is a contradiction contained in that. Maybe morality is the kind of thing that tells us sometimes we should fight each other. But I do think that there are contradictions in the area of this. So of course, if I think things like, I ought to vote for the best candidate and I ought to vote for the Republican, it's going to be very hard then for me to sort of satisfy Ewing's principle if it's never the case that one candidate is both. So there's a way in which sometimes think there's something right about Ewing's principle, but it's not read best as a kind of self-reliance principle. The kernel of truth contained in it is something like the Encratic requirement. And on the handout, you can see that this is what people now kind of call a kind of wide scope requirement. The requirement is not, once you've settled a question and convinced yourself you should do something, that's the thing you should do. Rather, it's the idea that you should see to it that there is a kind of coherence or match or mesh between your practical judgments or your normative beliefs and your intentions and actions. So what you ought to see to is that you don't simultaneously believe you ought to do something and then you do something else. And that's, of course, neutral on what needs to change. It could be, for example, that there's nothing wrong with your belief, in which case that belief should guide you. It could be, however, that there's something wrong with the belief, in which case that's something you should get rid of. So if you think about what the Encratic requirement says, it says something roughly like, when you come to the fork in the road, take it. In other words, it doesn't give you any advice at all. It just requires you, as it were, to either get your body in line with your head or get your head in line with the requirements that apply to the body. But although the Encratic requirement is a wide-scope requirement, it seems to require just a kind of coherence or mesh. It does have some funny properties. One thing it doesn't do is it doesn't sanction what I call in the handout simple detachment. So the Encratic requirement doesn't tell us that once we believe we ought to do something, that becomes the thing we ought to do. That's simple detachment. But it does sanction what I call in the handout normative detachment. So roughly the idea behind normative detachment is something like this. Suppose I conclude that I ought to do something, but suppose that thing is something that that should not be done. So I conclude for some reason that I should be giving bourbon to the baby. But if the situation is one in which babies shouldn't be given burden, what I'm not supposed to do is start pouring. What I'm supposed to do is start revising my attitudes. So the idea is roughly that if I come to a conclusion that I ought to do something, but that's on the list of things that are forbidden, I shouldn't start doing the forbidden thing. I should start revising my attitudes about what I ought to do. So as it were, we go from the prohibition against fying up against the permission to believe you ought to do something. Or if there really is something that is not just something I believe about what I ought to do, but it's something that I ought to believe about what I ought to do, then I can detach that that's the thing that I ought to do. So you can get a kind of downward detachment. But again, it's not just any old belief is one you ought to act on. It's, as it were, the special case of the beliefs you ought to have. Once there's a belief about what you ought to do, and that's the thing to believe, then that becomes the thing to do, as it were. So I think you get this very interesting phenomenon, which is that I think some people are quite attracted to the Encratic requirement. They think that captures some important truth that Ewing had in mind. But if you think the Encratic requirement is correct, then it looks like you have to think that your answer to sort of Pritchard's question about obligation will have a bearing on your epistemological views. So if you think the objective nature of the circumstance helps make it the case that some things shouldn't be done, You combine that with the encratic requirement, those very same features of the circumstance that compel you not to perform certain actions become things that become decisive reasons not to believe you ought to perform those actions. So as it were, the objective requirements are going to ramify up from action to intention to belief. A surprising number of people now seem attracted to something like the encratic requirement. Now, I don't know if that's just because they haven't thought about its terrible implications or what's going on, but I just want to point out that once you have the encratic requirement as part of your framework, you might wonder, well, if it's true, what makes it true? Why should we think that there is this principled connection between the requirements that apply to agents and the requirements that apply to people who think about what to do? And I have a very simple explanation. A very simple explanation for why the encratic requirement holds and for why normative detachment holds. Is you can just adopt a view on the, as it were, ought to believe or may believe, according to which you should never believe something that violates what you might call a factive norm. So Davide was talking about a kind of truth norm. You know, you shouldn't believe something that's false. Williamson has knowledge norms. You shouldn't believe something that isn't known. And on these factive accounts of justification, the encratic requirement is just a trivial consequence of the fact that you shouldn't believe falsehoods. There's no mystery there. So this sort of exotic principle that governs the link between belief and action has a very boring explanation. And that's why I'm an externalist. So if people want to know why it is that I think that the justification of belief depends upon objective features of the circumstance, it's because I have a normative theory that incorporates the encratic requirement. It seems like a good principle. I think the kernel of truth in Ewing's principle is the encratic requirement. But I also can't shake this idea that, as some people put it, features of the circumstance are part of what determines what we ought to do. This is not a popular view. So, you know, close friends of mine, when they discuss these kinds of things, think that, you know, this kind of knowledge account of justification, although it's accepted by people like Williamson and McDowell and myself, they think it's such a bad idea that, you know, we shouldn't even put it on the syllabus because, you know, sort of, there's a norm which is don't teach your students bad ideas. And this is sort of so beyond the pale of things we should think about in epistemology that it shouldn't sort of be, you know, in the table of things to think about. Fair enough. I would like to point out that, as far as I can tell, the only sensible explanation for the encratic requirement is going to appeal to this very ham-handed epistemological principle, which says roughly you should never believe something unless you know it. And every effort I've seen to explain the encratic principle using something more subtle and sophisticated has led to difficulties. So I'm just going to discuss one of the ways in which you can be led into difficulties if you abandoned my very simple, crude picture of justification. So just one thing to note about the encratic requirement, and I'm sorry for using the board, but when we're thinking about phying, it can come into one of three categories. It can be, you know, in the things that are forbidden, and the things that are required, or the things that are neither. And if you accept the encratic requirement, you get this very funny feature, which is that a justified normative belief can't miss by too much. So for example, if you accept the encratic requirement and you're thinking about phying, if it's the case that you ought not, then you can't have the justified belief that you ought. It's a very weird thing, because if your general epistemological framework is one in which, say, really strong evidence that points in favor of a proposition makes it appropriate to believe, even if it's false, you might wonder, why is it then that there's this weird kind of belief such that it can't miss by too much and be justified? It's a very strange thing. Again, the very natural explanation is if you think no false belief can be justified be believed, this is just, as it were, an application of the general rule. But if that's not your attitude, you might wonder, how could it be that there's this weird dependence between not missing the facts by too much and having a justified belief? It's, I think, a very difficult thing to explain. And we'll come back to this. But now I want to introduce a problem for the view that I like and an alternative framework, and this is the problem. As soon as you start to say, like, like Davide did earlier, that you shouldn't believe things that are false, or the sort of Williamsonian idea that you shouldn't believe things unless you know them, or the McDowellian idea if you prefer, you're always going to face a kind of argument from error. And the way that arguments from error typically work is we start with what we'll call a good case. And this is the case where a thinker knows that P is true. So just fill out the case in such a way that you become convinced that the thinker knows that the thing is true. And then what we do is we construct a bad case involving an epistemic counterpart, where an epistemic counterpart is going to be defined as a thinker that has the same kind of internal, subjective, non-factive mental profile as you. So if you like to put yourself in the good case, your epistemic counterpart might also be in the good case, but they might be in a bad case. And what sort of makes for the counterpart relation has to do with mental similarity. So imagine you have an epistemic counterpart. In this case, they're going to believe P, but because it's a bad case, that belief won't be knowledge. But they're going to be, you know, similar to you mentally down to the last qualia. So any difference between you and them is going to be all outside of the mind and totally inaccessible to them. And when you think about them in their situation, according to the sort of rule that says you should not believe P unless you know it, it would follow that although they believe P, they ought not believe P. They shouldn't believe P for reasons that are, of course, totally inaccessible to them. Reasons that are outside of the mind, that never crossed their mind, that they couldn't become aware of, that would never occur to them. And that, some people say, seems deeply counterintuitive. Okay, so there's just the intuition. But then what some people say is there's an important sort of insight that explains that intuition. And that insight I have on the handout has to do with guidance. So Jonathan Way and Daniel Whiting, although they're fans of the Encratic requirement, they like to say things like, a familiar and intuitive thought is that normative reasons have to be able to guide us. That's what reasons seem to be for. Considerations that can't guide us can't do what reasons are supposed to do. To put the same point differently, it's the job of a reason to recommend that a person perform an act or hold an attitude. If it's to do that job, the person must be able to heed and respond to the recommendation. So on the model that I like, the mere fact that a person is in a bad case becomes a decisive reason for them not to believe, but that reason, as it were, can't make a call that sort of reaches the person that it tries to apply to. There's this kind of disconnect. The reason is saying, don't believe this, but of course you, the agent, can't possibly register that. There's no such reason here. And the sort of waiting waypoint is that whatever reasons make it the case that this is true, since they can't reach that person, they can't really do what reasons are supposed to do. And if they can't do what reasons are supposed to do, then they wouldn't make it the case that you ought not believe. And so we have a counterexample. Some people like this view are much ruder about this point, and they say funnier things. So my former dissertation supervisor slash comedian slash the most sort of evil of the internalists like to say that there's one categorical imperative, which is don't be an idiot. And roughly what that says is, you know, if you come to a conclusion about what you ought to do, and then you don't do it, you're acting like an idiot. And this person will reason about what they ought to do in just the way that you do. All of the considerations that seem appealing to you will seem appealing to them. If they didn't come to the conclusions you drew, they would be foolish. If they came to a conclusion about what they ought to do and didn't do it, they would be foolish. So there's a kind of categorical requirement, which is that a person in this situation should be a lot like a person in that situation. And if in this situation you allow yourself to believe, in that situation you should be allowed to believe. And Errol Lord in a new book says roughly the same kind of thing. The only way to comply with this kind of requirement is to take kind of a wild stab where you just suspend judgment for no reason. And if someone asked you, why are you suspending judgment, you'd say, no reason. It seems to me for all the world that this is true. I would bet my life on it, and I'm just suspending judgment. And that seems kind of bonkers. And so the idea is that the normative couldn't be like that. The normative could not demand that we do things like that, because then it wouldn't play its guiding role. And if the normative does anything, it's supposed to function as a guide. But to function as a guide, it has to be able to reach us. So this knowledge account of justification fails because it implies there are reasons that can't guide. Okay. This is, I think, an interesting idea, this idea that for reasons to do what they're supposed to do, by making certain things required or forbidden, or just permitted, that they have to be able to guide us. I think it's interesting because there is something deeply appealing to it, but I also think that it is impossible to come up with a satisfactory normative framework that vindicates that idea. And if it's impossible to come up with a normative framework that vindicates that idea, that's some reason to think that it's a bad idea, as tempting as it is. I can't obviously discuss all of the alternatives to the very simplistic view that I like, so I'm just going to discuss one alternative to the simplistic view I like. And what I like about this view is that it's an attempt to strike a kind of compromise. To say, on the one hand, what obligates or creates prohibitions has to reach you, but it nevertheless can be found in the external circumstance. So the reasons perspectivist, what they think is, as it were, the answer to Pritchard's question is that features of the circumstance can sometimes obligate. But with this qualification, they can only do so if such features are made available to you. So as it were, it is the circumstance that can create the obligation, but only in the special condition where it's available to you or you possess those reasons. And so roughly what people like this think is that on the handout, I have this idea that normative reasons are typically facts about the situation, the kinds of things we think of as pros and cons. Those things do work together to determine what we should do. In so doing, they ensure that the thing we ought to do would be rational or reasonable to do. And interestingly, what's rational or reasonable to do is wholly determined by the subjective aspects of our mental life. So you don't get this bizarre thing where, as it were, in this case you ought to do one thing, but in this case where you're a mental duplicate, you ought to do something else. The key to them is this idea that, as it were, the potent reasons, the potent normative reasons, are always going to be things you know. Of course, and sometimes our knowledge extends to things external to us. Such things, when known, can be part of what obligates us. But when such things become invisible, they no longer obligate. And so then the idea would be roughly that just in the same way that this person is allowed to believe things because the external world is revealed to them, this person is allowed to believe things because, as it were, the reasons for them not to believe are all hidden, and hence they're not potent. They are sort of switched off. So the switched on reasons are the things that you know. Sometimes you know very little, and sometimes you know a lot. But the hope is that whenever you have epistemic counterparts, they're still going to be permitted, required, and forbidden from doing the same things. So you don't get failures of guidance, but you do get this idea that sometimes the external world can help determine what you ought to do. That's the dream. It seems to give us the encratic requirement. It seems to give us the right answer to Pritchard's question, but it's supposed to satisfy the guidance idea. I'm going to go kind of quickly. I have a very long paper where I try to show that this move that they make can't possibly work, 17 different ways. And I'm not going to go through the 17 different ways in which I think the move fails, because it's excessive. You won't, it's unnecessary. I'll just go through a few. But the rough idea is an idea that they picked up from Jonathan Dansey, who insists that he didn't take this seriously. This was just one of those things that he said and hoped no one would run with. And yet they did. So the maneuver that he wanted was something like this. We can imagine, as it were, these agents in worlds in which various things are true. And then he said something like, you can have a view on which the things that determine obligation are typically things out here, but only the ones that in some sense pass through an epistemic filter. So you can think of it as like the things you see or the things you know or the kind of things that are visible in the situation. But those things that are hidden, unknown, or invisible, they're features of the world, but they don't bear an obligation. So as your knowledge expands or contracts, the things on the pro and con side, right, their comparative weights can vary. But to determine what you ought to do, you just think about the set of facts you know, the weights those things have, and that will determine what you ought to do. So to give a very simple kind of example of this, suppose you know both that you have a friend waiting in a diner, but a child has fallen into a pond, so you know both things. We think, look, the needs of a friend, that carries some non-trivial weight. But the needs of a child, you know, carries more weight. And so when you weigh up those two things that you know, you go with the stronger reason and you ought to jump into a pond. Very simple case for practical reason. Okay. Now, let's then imagine that that is the good case, just to see how this works. So in one case, you know both. There's a friend waiting at the diner, that's the D. And you also know that there's a child in the pond, that's the P. So these are the things that you know. And it seems like in this kind of case, what you ought to do is jump into the pond, not walk by, wave to the child, and meet your friend for lunch. Suppose, though, that what you know is just that there's a child in the pond. You falsely believe that your friend is at the diner. You misremembered the date. Fill in the details however you like. Then the idea would be that you could be the mental duplicate of this person and you still jump. And intuitively, this is what people think, that as long as we're dealing with your epistemic counterparts, the same things will be rational, but also the same things will be most favored by the reasons. I don't quite understand how this is supposed to work, actually, if you do the following permutation. In this example, we could call this the best case. You know both. There's a friend at a diner and a child in a pond, and you weigh those up, and it's obvious you have to jump in and help the child, not go meet your friend and let the child drown. If we take away the friend, all we're doing, right, is making it the case that there's only pros that count in favor of jumping in, nothing that counts against. So jumping in still seems to be the thing that's required by the reasons. But what happens when we move to this permutation where there is a diner but no child? Of course, mentally what you're telling yourself is that the list of pros and cons include a child in danger and a friend in need. That's what you tell yourself, but those aren't facts in the situation. The only fact in the situation you know is that there is a friend waiting in the diner. If that's the right list, then it looks like the thing to do is to walk by. That's what the reasons require. Because on the pro side of reasons to go by, you've got a friend in need. In the con side of walking by, you tell yourself there's a child in danger, but there's no child. So you write down something on your list of pros and cons that is no pro or con at all. So it looks like we get this very strange situation that in terms of what's most favored by reasons, we get variability. But the view is designed to say that when it comes to the requirements of rationality, we're supposed to get sameness. This looks like a clash. This looks like a straightforward clash in which what is most favored by the things you know can vary. Although, again, you might think that what's most rational would be invariant. And once you get that kind of invariance at the level of rationality, you get a violation of guidance. That kind of idea, I think, shows that there's something problematic about the epistemic filter view, and I'll just tell you what I think is problematic about it. A filter is supposed to deal with cases of ignorance, features of the situation you're unaware of. That's not what we're dealing with here. This is a case of mistake. Mistakes are not the same thing. Mistakes are, as it were, taking there to be features of a situation that aren't there, which is not a matter of failing to see features of the situation that are there. This filter is great for handling ignorance, but is utterly incapable of dealing with any kind of mistake. So if you're guided by the intuition that mistaken beliefs are not a failure of rationality, you might say, yes, the same action, the same beliefs would be rational in each case. But if your view is that reasons to act are features of the situation, don't assume that the weight of the pros and the cons will always, as it were, line up with your most rational judgment about those weights. Okay, so that's, I think, one kind of problem case. And in the longer version of the paper, I talk about other ways in which an epistemic filter is incapable of doing all of the things we need for it. Very quickly, I just want to give a couple more examples of the kind of thing that I think show that even if you introduce this filter, you'll never quite get reasons and rationality to match up in the way that you want to. I don't know what people think about moral testimony as a source of knowledge, but life is short, so I'll just tell you what I think. I think, that sometimes people can come to know what they ought to do through moral testimony.
How?
Well, I mean, you know, you give your best theory of testimonial knowledge, and that's how. So I think sometimes what happens is you have an agent. They're wondering what to do. They have a reliable informant who has a fabulous track record, seems to understand the human situation in ways that exceed how they understand the situation. They know this person understands the situation better than they do. This person tells them that they ought to fire, and I think this could be something they come to know. Bye. And then they're considering whether they ought to sigh, and they come to believe ought sigh via testimony from the same person. So you have this, it could be a guru, it could be a rabbi, it could be a philosopher, it could be a more sober version of yourself. There are various sources you could go to for moral testimony. But I think, as I think moral testimony is a good source of moral knowledge, I think the following thing can happen. You can come to know that you ought to do something because someone tells you. But of course, since that person's fallible, you can sometimes just come to believe you ought to do something because they tell you. In fact, sometimes I think what happens in these moral testimony cases is that you get a situation where someone tells you you ought to do something, but in fact, you ought not. I think, again, we just get a straightforward kind of problem here. Remember, what the Encratic requirement said is that a belief about what you ought to do can't be justified and false if it misses by too much. It would follow from the Encratic requirement and the fact that this shouldn't be done that you ought not believe ought sigh. Of course, if you know ought phi, then of course it's not going to be the case that you ought not believe ought phi. You have a requirement not to act on that belief and to abandon it. There's no requirement not to act on that belief and abandon it. This just seems like a straightforward case that if you think of fallible testimonial sources as a potential source of moral knowledge, and you think that the normative reasons are the things you come to know, you just get a straightforward case where, in this case, you should not believe, in this case, you should. But the reasons in light of which that is so are just not accessible to you. So the question is, how do we avoid these kind of counterexamples? I can think of one and only one way to, well, two ways to avoid these kind of counterexamples. One way to avoid this counterexample is to say, the following cases are not possible because moral testimony is not a source of knowledge. I find that a bit hard to swallow because I do think, for example, we often give ourselves moral testimony. And I think we thereby give ourselves future moral knowledge. You know you're going to go into situations where you're tempted or drunk or confused or tired, so you tell yourself in advance what you ought to do. And in that state, you defer to a formal self, and that seems like a good way of coming to know what to do in the situation. I find this idea that to avoid these kinds of puzzle cases, we would deny testimony as a source of moral knowledge is sort of too extreme a response to deal with what seems like a very trivial problem. A different way to deal with this, though, is like this. You can do what we call top-down reasoning. Suppose your friend's testimony is, of course, the testimony of a reliable informant, someone who's a potential source of moral knowledge, and they tell you you ought to do something. It becomes a reasonable thing to think. So you believe you're in this situation. If you believe you're in that situation, and by hypothesis the belief is made rational by their testimony, then maybe it's impossible to be in this situation. By having sufficient evidence to believe you ought to do something, couldn't that just become the thing you ought to do? That would be a kind of top-down reasoning. There are philosophers who endorse this kind of top-down reasoning. Richard Foley endorses this kind of top-down reasoning. John Gibbons endorses this kind of top-down reasoning. I do not endorse this kind of top-down reasoning, and I think there's a good reason not to endorse this kind of top-down reasoning. I can't get into all of the details, but I'll just say one reason that we should not engage this kind of top-down reasoning is when a person's got it into their head that they're under some kind of requirement, that won't make them try to meet the requirement. No matter how confused you get in your moral philosophy class, and you start believing in lots of requirements that, as it were, you never thought were there, I don't think we should think that those things become binding just because you've come to rationally draw these conclusions. So I have a paper where I discuss this kind of case in greater detail, but just one way to think of it is like this. Imagine someone who All I'll tell you about them is that they have more conservative views about sexual ethics than you do. That's all there is to it. By your lights, they believe in requirements that do not exist. And then you might ask, could they be coherent? Sure, why not, right? You don't assume that people who have more restrictive conservative views are incoherent. You just disagree about things. They believe in requirements you do not. Could they have good evidence for your views? It's a bit insulting to think that people who have more conservative views don't have equally good evidence for their views, right? That seems kind of insulting. So it seems like, yeah, they could have good evidence for their views. Could they be rational in believing what they ought to believe? Well, again, if you're working with this very permissive notion of rationality, where, as it were, rationality doesn't require knowledge, why not? So then you start thinking of these people who have more conservative views than you, that they have rational beliefs about what they're required to do. If that's what they ought to believe about what they ought to do, and we like this kind of top-down reasoning, then it looks like they're under an obligation to live according to views that, by your own lights, are mistaken. And then there's this very weird phenomenon, which is, if it's really the case that what they ought to do is act in accordance with their, by your lights, too conservative views, you might wonder, what should you think of them when they're acratic? Because none of us is, as it were, immune to acrasia. I sit there with Julian and he convinces me I should be a vegetarian, and I'm like, I will definitely have the steak. And maybe he sits there and convinces me, you know, probably wouldn't convince me of this, but you can imagine, again, someone sitting in a moral philosophy class being convinced that only essentially procreative acts are morally permitted, but the cable goes out, bottles of wine come out, and next thing you know, everyone's naked. That happens. Now, we looking into that situation, I think it is perverse for us to blame, criticize, or say that they failed to meet an obligation. So I really think that this kind of top-down way of vindicating the incratic requirement is a really kind of crazy, dangerous idea. But if you don't like top-down versions of the incratic requirement, you're left with this puzzle. It looks like, if you accept the guidance idea, insofar as you ought to be guided by this, you ought to be guided by that. If you like the incratic requirement, you ought to see to it that your actions mesh with your beliefs. So either you're committed to the view that a person's confused beliefs based on misleading evidence become obligating, and I think it's perverse to think that people are obligated to live in accordance with their views like that. Or if you accept the incratic requirement, you have to think that the guidance principle is in some sense unsatisfiable. There's not going to be any normative framework in which, in every circumstance under which someone's obligated to do something, they're in a position to recognize it and act accordingly. Now, since people want to hear about epistemology, it's probably good to give an epistemic example. So let me give you an epistemic example of this phenomenon that concerns me. And I'll bring it back to this issue about rationality supervening on the mental. So, imagine you were going to write a work of nonfiction, and, you know, just to sort of minimize the chance of making mistakes, you're going to make it about yourself. So you're going to write the story of your life, and you fill this book only with things that you think of as the best candidates for knowledge. So every entry in that book has been carefully checked against any evidence or records you might have. Anything that is the slightest bit dodgy, doubtful, or uncertain, you strike from the book. And at the end of this process, you have this very lengthy book about your life, the story of you. You employ a fact checker, and you know what happens next. The body of the book contains, let's say, 1 million claims. The fact checker comes along and says, I found that there's a mistake. So that's the preface thing. Being an intellectually honest person, you enter that into your book, and you ask them where the mistake is, and of course they drop dead, and they're never able to tell you. So now you have a book with 1,000,001 sentences, and you know the following. There's no possible world in which the book expresses 1,000,001 true propositions. And now I think we face an interesting choice point. Can we come to know from the testimony of a fact checker that a book contains an error? I would have thought the answer was yes. So I think of this as a potential object of knowledge. You could know that. Next question, would that destroy the knowledge in the rest of the book? I hope not. I do think all of us know of ourselves that we harbor at least one false belief, but I hate to think that that recognition of our own fallibility acts as an awesome defeater that destroys the rest of the knowledge we have. I think I still know I'm in France, I think I still know my name is Clayton, and I think I know that I have at least one false belief. So if we think that knowledge of the preface sentence's truth doesn't destroy knowledge here, but each of the claims in the book was a good candidate for knowledge, then I think what we could get is the following scenario. Maybe this is a bit extreme, but it's good to think about a simple model and you can try to negotiate into a more complicated one. There's no world in which you know 1,000,001 things. So how much can you know? Maybe you can know 1,000,000 things. Maybe if there's an error in the body of the book, you know that the preface sentence is true. Of course, you don't know the false thing in the book is true because knowledge requires truth. But again, if knowledge of your own errors don't destroy large chunks of knowledge, there's no reason to think that it's going to destroy the knowledge in the section on birds and then leave untouched the knowledge you have in the section of fishes or the section of train trips or any of those kinds of things. It looks like there's sort of no way that the defeating power of that knowledge could specifically hone in on anything in particular. So maybe, as it were, you could know precisely 1,000,000 things in circumstances like this. But what you know depends upon which of the entries in that book are mistaken. So in one world, you know 1,000,000 things, but it's all in the body. In every other world, you know 1,000,000 things, but it's one thing in the preface and 999,999 things in the body. What's known, of course, will vary from world to world. The amount of knowledge would be invariant. On the reasons perspectivist view we're looking at, the idea is something like this. You're supposed to take the things you know, and then you're supposed to treat them as normative reasons. So for example, if I know that a book contains an error, I'm aware of a reason that looks like a decisive reason not to have credence one in every entry here. Because if I had credence one in every entry here, and I knew that there was an error there, I would violate this norm that we would call probabilism, which is I should be probabilistically coherent. Seems like a good norm. So if my knowledge is there, I should not be maximally confident in all of the truths here. Of course, if I had a bit of knowledge here, I shouldn't be maximally confident there. In every world, what you're supposed to do is distribute your credences in such a way that your credences concerning logical truths sum up to one and no less. So the only way to be probabilistically coherent in this framework is to adjust your credences to what you know, but thereby adjust them differently depending upon which world you're in. In the world where you don't know this thing, you want to be very confident in these things, and for that reason, very unconfident in that thing. Or in the world where you know this thing, you have to be very confident in that thing, very confident in all the other things in the body that you don't know, but if the error is on page 76, line 52, that thing you should be very unconfident in. I know you're saying that sounds bonkers. There's no way that what you ought to do is adjust your credences differently in these worlds so that you would be maximally confident that the thing that happens to be false is false. That sounds crazy, because then it sounds like you should be willing to accept bets about the location of the error, where, as it were, you would be willing to take a very small payoff and risk quite a lot to take the bet. That sounds bonkers. I agree. I'm not telling you that that's what you should do. I'm simply pointing out that if you have a normative framework that tells you that you ought to adjust yourself to the facts that you know, you get these very bizarre results. Once you have that as one of your fundamental commitments, I don't think you will ever get a view on which guide, as stated on the handout, comes out to be correct. There can always potentially be these differences in what you're required to do that, as it were, are going to be contained in features of the circumstance that will be obscure to you. The only way to avoid that is to withdraw from the idea that the normative reasons themselves are found in the features of the circumstance that you know. And maybe that's the right thing to do. Maybe the right thing to do is to say that the right answer to Pritchard's question was to say that an agent's obligation never depends upon the features of the circumstance, even the ones they know. That an agent's obligation is always wholly determined by characteristics of the agent's thought. The characteristics of the agent's thought that figure in our assessment of how reasonable or rational they are. You can adopt a view on which those considerations about a subject's mind that determine the rational status of their beliefs and actions wholly determine what they ought to do. But then you should probably think of this talk of normative reasons as features of the circumstance, as a kind of vestige of a very crude and outdated way of thinking about obligation. What you should not do is try to combine them. So as I see it, if you like the normative frameworks in which objective features of the circumstance can impress themselves upon us and require us to do things, I think it's unavoidable that you're going to have to give up the guidance idea. But if you like the guidance idea, perhaps you should give up on this idea of reasons being found in the circumstance. Anything else, I think, is going to be an inherently unstable compromise that will either do violence to what we think of as what the reasons require, or do violence to what we think of as what rationality permits. Right. As far as I can tell, then, the real problem of guidance is this. If you like my answer to Pritchard's question, you should hate the idea that the normative is there to guide us. Do I have like a minute left? 1 minute? Okay. So 1 minute left, here's then what I would say. When people start saying things like normative reasons are there to guide you, you should be a bit worried, because guidance, I think, in these contexts is ambiguous. One way that something can be a guide is that it's simply a standard. It sets out a standard, and it's a standard you should meet, and it doesn't have much to do with you at all. Sometimes, though, what a guide is supposed to do is reach you where you are and take you somewhere. And you might wonder, is there anything in the universe that could play both roles? How could something be that kind of impersonal standard for appropriateness, but also tailored to me if, as it were, the standard knows nothing about me? It doesn't know about my ignorance. It doesn't know about my biases. It doesn't know about my perversity. How could it possibly be that the thing that will, as it were, establish appropriateness always resonate with me, of course, if I am, like all of you, so terribly inappropriate? So I think when people talk about guidance, you should ask, are you talking about a standard of correctness that is impersonal and does not tailor itself to us? Or are you talking about directions that are personalized, but then for that reason would have to be recognized as fallible guides to that other impersonal thing? And if someone doesn't mark that distinction between a recipe and a standard, then you should think that they are equivocating in a very dangerous way. All right, that's all I have to say, so I'll stop there.
Thank you.